This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the November-December 2019 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Shucked by Sam J. Miller. Adney had seen the man staring well before he spoke to them. Two tables over in the otherwise empty restaurant, loud with the sound of waves against the breakwater, 50-something, poor posture, took good care of himself, a tourist like them. She could tell by the clumsy way he'd conversed with the woman behind the bar. A guest at the hotel upstairs, hence he was unburdened by bags or backpacks like the ones at their feet. It happened from time to time. People stared. One of the burdens of being with a boy as beautiful as Teak. This guy at least had the decency not to pretend she didn't exist. He was transfixed by her boyfriend, yes, but he was also assessing her. When he caught her staring back, when their eyes locked, he smiled affably. But was affable the right word? There was something else happening in his eyes, something less friendly, conspiratorial almost, like eye contact had made them complicit in something. Teak was immersed in his phone, trying to decide what tourist-type spot to visit when they left the restaurant. She picked his camera up off the table and took a picture of them. When it flashed on the screen, she tried to see it as if he were a stranger to her. Black hair cropped close, olive skin darkened by a week of vacation sun, untamable stubble. Hazel eyes that seemed always to be aimed down, slim, slight, an overall sense of delicacy, fragility even. In the background, out of focus, the man, clearly staring, maybe smiling. To tell Teak or not, he'd find it funny for sure, but might it also make him self-conscious, or worse, swell his ego so it tipped over into insufferable? They had not been dating long enough to know for sure, so she said nothing. The woman behind the bar was pouring water from one big glass pitcher into many smaller ones. She was old and stout and said little, but always had a smile for her. They'd come to the same place every night since they arrived in Amalfi. Teak had said last night that she was super mean, and Adney was dazzled at how they had such different experiences of the same person. She struggled with the oyster she was shucking. "Let me," Teak said, and she handed it over and marveled at how effortlessly he sank the knife into the hinge, wobbled the hand that held the oyster until the blade made a full circumference, peeled back the shell, severed the muscle that bound the meat to its hard, translucent platter. Where had he learned to do that? He'd come from a pathetic inland Jersey strip mall exurb, same as she did. A summer working in a fancy spot down the shore, she imagined, and could see it quite vividly. Teak in a white apron, Teak the apple of the eye of every man and woman at the country club. "I always hated oysters," she said. "My father loved them. We couldn't afford to buy them hardly ever, and it was a big deal when we did. Once he'd shuck them, and when he wasn't looking, I'd dump them all out onto the ice and swap them back into the wrong shells. I thought I was getting away with something." "That's pretty dumb." "Yeah," she said, "I was 6. "Why did you order them if you hate them?" She shrugged. After that, the silence came flooding back in like the tide. She indulged in that thing everyone had been doing last semester. Shut your eyes and you can hear your student loan debt piling up. Cents per second, dollars per minute. The church has some amazing art, apparently, he said, holding up the phone to show a church not far from them, including a disputed Caravaggio. Is it free? She asked. He scrolled down and gave a thumbs up. Well, let's do that, she said. They'd met in art history last semester, so that was one thing they could have a conversation about. This was the second mostly silent lunch in a row. 2 weeks is probably too long, she thought, for a vacation together so early in a relationship, especially when neither one of us has any money. Outside of bed, there is not so much of a spark, and there's only so long we can stay in bed. Even through the glass, the afternoon waves were very loud. She remembered the woman at the hostel explaining the complex system of bells used to signal the start and end of high and low tide. Amalfi was eerily empty of tourists that week. Everyone had a theory why. Teak picked up his camera, pointed it at the water, put it down without taking a picture. Lately, he'd been doing that a lot. He was obsessed with photography and could talk endlessly about the work he wanted to do, the aesthetic he aspired to, grungy, gritty, high fashion, but the actual taking of photographs rarely happened. She watched waves punish the Amalfi jetty, crashing against it, sending up spray and high glass curtains. Like white elephants, she thought, and rolled her eyes at herself. Last night, they'd wanted to walk out along the breakwater, but she'd been too afraid. You're a lucky woman, the man said, startling them both. Am I? She said, not a question. Teak turned around and took the man in for the first time, trying to determine whether he represented a threat. Obviously, the man said. You're sitting with the most handsome man in this or any city. Teak's face broke into a wide, self-conscious smile and then swiftly reddened, gratified but embarrassed. His awkward happiness softened Adney's initial anger at the man's intrusion. He got up, dressed. She smiled at him, aware that doing so was a kind of encouragement, but she was bored, and the break in their long shared silence was not completely unwelcome. You're Americans? Yes, she said, we are. Don't hold it against us. He had an accent. She couldn't place it and didn't want to ask. Well, forgive my impertinence, he said. I'm sorry to be so forward, but I believe it's best to cut right to the chase when it comes to strange offers. Offers? Adney said. Teak's blush deepened. Strange ones. From a briefcase she hadn't noticed, he took a massive stack of bills. I'll give you $10,000 for 1 hour of your boyfriend's time. No one said anything. The sound of the sea had dropped out entirely, replaced with the quickening thud of her own blood in her ears. Teak squirmed. She waited for him to reject the offer, but his mouth remained a rigid wobble. She wondered what he was thinking, feeling. Her own emotions were strangely absent. As ever, he was unreadable. Was he excited at the thought of being turned into a rent boy? Horrified? Humiliated that the offer was made to her and not to him, as if his own feelings on the matter were irrelevant? Or did that same fact arouse him? It was a constant source of frustration for her, how little Teak said about what was going on inside his head, how he was still a mystery to her, along with all his traumas and fears and hopes and funny stories. Adney made herself laugh. Get out of here, she said. Because somebody had to reject the offer and Teak wasn't. The man turned to Teak. Teak's frown sharpened. They both had outside hookups, sometimes. It was within the rules they'd fashioned for themselves, and Teak had been with boys, since they'd started dating, even. Not his favorite thing. One of his friends, usually, drunk and pushy and pleading. Teak was good-natured like that, eager to make someone happy if he could. There were no rules for this. How had he known they needed the money? But of course they did. They were Americans. Americans were either obscenely rich or super poor, and they were obviously not the former. 1 hour doing what? Teak asked. The man put both hands on the table. They were big, coarse, hairy. The sight of them thrilled her as if she was the one he wanted to grab hold of. We're not children here. I don't think I need to spell it out. I'll respect your boundaries, of course, but I'm not paying you to talk. Can we have some time to think about this? Teak asked. You cannot, the man said, and this too was thrilling to Adney, and the thrill unsettled her. She imagined the most degrading of demands being issued to her in that same imperious, commanding tone, but of course it wasn't her he'd be degrading. Teak looked at her, pretty eyes wide, like, what the fuck, this is so bizarre, but also like, what do we do? A giddy tremor shivered through her. He's waiting for me to say yes or no, she realized. This is up to me. It would mean eating dinner at all the restaurants they'd had to pass by the last 5 nights, moving from the precarious cliffside hostel outside of town, high up the unlit hill, and into one of the grand old hotels in town, going on to Venice, being able to afford delivery all semester long when school started back up, making a dent in that mountain of loan debt. They came so easily, the cold equations of pimping her boyfriend. Do it if you want to do it, she said, and he frowned, but she could see the excitement in his eyes, or at least that's what she told herself she could see. Why the fuck not? Teak said. The man handed her a stack. That's half. I'll give him the other half when he's finished. He was handsome, she saw for the first time. Sharp chin, well-kept beard, eloquent eyebrows, the slightest shabbiness around the edges overall, like he too came from a fallen place. Bye, Teak said, grinning. He stood, then stooped to kiss her. You're sure this is okay? She asked. Of course, he said, showing teeth. This was him, the eager, boyish thing she'd fallen for, but it was also not him, or not the him she'd known. Another facet revealed, the fact that he'd sell himself, like when she learned he smoked. She liked it, she thought. She hoped. Be careful, she said, and then they were gone. The woman behind the bar smiled at her. She knows, Adney thought. She saw it all in our faces, but she knew that was illogical. If they had been in America, the woman would have come over, filled her coffee cup, but they weren't, so Adney had to get up to fetch another espresso. A long, narrow mirror stretched along the back wall, brand new with beveled edges. Adney imagined an ancient one before it, broken in a brawl or tiny, non-newsworthy earthquake. She watched their reflections, the old woman's and hers, two broad noses, one Roman and one pure New York, two survivors of shattered empires, one gone 2,000 years, the other so recently most people hadn't noticed it yet, about the same height. Would her black hair go gray as spectacularly as this woman's had? Easy to imagine them as avatars of each other, or this woman with deft, arthritic hands as a future version of herself. Back at her table, she tried and failed several times to lose herself in the book she'd brought, but it was proving impossible to think of anything other than what was happening upstairs. Would the man want to fuck Teak, or would he want Teak to fuck him? Would it be vanilla, or very, very not? More worrisome was wondering how Teak would be when he came downstairs. Would this push him back into one of his glum, silent, blue periods? Or would he return buoyed up, excited, energized in a way that sex with her had not been able to do for him lately? And which would be worse? She took a cigarette out of the pack he'd left on the table, held it up in the woman's direction. She shrugged. Adney lit it, sucked in smoke, held it in her mouth, did not inhale, blew it out in a slow, narrow billow. An hour passed fast, or maybe it wasn't that long at all. Maybe they finished far sooner. Teak came down alone, back pocket bulging, walking with no discernible limp or other evidence of trauma, smiling. "Hey," she said when he lowered his face to her. She flinched, afraid of what his lips might taste like, and that made him laugh, and then he kissed her, and they tasted like nothing. Teak smiled quizzically, possibly noticing she'd smoked. "Shall we go on to the church?" he asked. He left a lot of money on the table and winked at the woman on their way out. For the first time, Adney noticed how she frowned at him. Cold wind came off the ocean. Late afternoon by then, dark clouds piling up. He took her hand and they walked into the ancient, tattered city. "Are you okay?" she asked. "Sure am," he said and squeezed her hand. How was it?" "Fine," he said. Did you..." "Cool if we don't talk about it right now?" Teak asked. "I mean, I get it. You have the right to know everything that went down, and I'll totally tell you, just not right now?" "Of course," she said, and leaned in to rest her head on his shoulder. Something about it was off, though. Their heads did not fit together the way they normally did. His posture seemed somehow poorer. "You're okay, though, right? Really okay? Super okay." He kissed the top of her head. Women watched them go from several stories up. Clothes shook on laundry lines. Streets split, narrowed, became tunnels, opened up again. She wondered if she'd be able to tell whether the disputed Caravaggio was real or not, and whether it would be good, even if it wasn't real. But the church was closed in contradiction of the clearly posted hours and with no sign to say why. "Shit," she said, and sat down on a stone square that once helped men up onto horses. Already a smell of garlic frying in olive oil was filling the air. Dinner time was close and so was darkness. They'd have to climb up the steep road to the south, get their stuff from the hostel, come back to find a hotel. Her feet hurt from thinking about it. "You're so beautiful when you're sad," he said, uncapping his camera. The compliment was uncharacteristic. Her face showed it, and she heard the shutter snap. "I'm a world-famous photographer," he said, smiling, squatting. "And you're a supermodel who suddenly became a recluse at the height of her fame. This is your first shoot in 2 years." A wide, warm smile shivered through her, but smiling would not have been in keeping with the character she'd been giving. She forced herself to purse her lips, pout. "How could I pass up the chance to work with you, in spite of your reputation? What's the shoot?" "Cigarette ad," he said, tossing his pack to her. The game was welcome, but it too was uncharacteristic. She shook one loose, held it in her fingers, extended her arm in front of her as elegantly as she could, arched her back artfully. Shutter snaps came in quick succession, and she moved her body slightly after each one, curled a finger, cocked a smile, raised an eyebrow, flicked a foot. It was like sex a little, the way it warmed her up. When was the last time he'd made her feel that way outside of bed? At a party, she recalled, at the end of the semester. He'd beckoned her over, told a semicircle of his friends about her printmaking, fake posters for fake 70s bands. Where had it come from, this energy, this excitement, the ability to take pictures when he hadn't in so long? What had that guy done to him? Adney should have been grateful, but she wasn't. In a slow unfurling, the tiny hairs along her spine stood up. "There's a crocodile," he said. "For the shoot," she said. "Good at this game. Brilliant. Must have been costly." He waved his hand. "The client is filthy rich with lung cancer money. Let them pay to make our dreams real, to bring our brilliant art into the world." "Where is it?" she asked. "Out on the breakwater," he said. "Really?" she said, scared, excited. They headed back down the way they had come. "Stop," he said, at a barrow overflowing with lemons, and had her pose there, clasping one with both hands. Sfusato, the oversized Amalfi Coast lemons that local farmers had created over the course of centuries, breeding together local bitter oranges with tiny inedible lemons from Arab traders. The trees grew everywhere in the stone city and the high hills around it. Stalls sold soaps, candy, pastries, and pasta infused with lemon essence. "Magnificent," he said when she kissed it. And that was when the thought came, bursting fully formed in her brain. Preposterous, irrational, but certain. The hairs standing on end all over her body said so. "This isn't teak." "Yes," he said at the way her face suddenly became something else, thinking her horror wasn't hers, was the character's. "I've never heard him use the word magnificent in all our time together." "Brilliant," said the bi with the camera as she stared past its lens and into the familiar green flecks of his hazel eyes. They swapped bodies. That man pulled teak out of his skin as easily as teak shucked that oyster from his shell, slid himself in, young again, alive and energetic and beautiful. It was easy telling herself to stop being stupid. Things like that couldn't happen. She smiled and he stepped forward. "Goosebumps," he said, taking an extreme close-up of her shoulder. "It's cold," she said. "Crocodiles hate the cold," he said. She succeeded in suppressing a shiver when he took her hand. Was his grip different? Tighter? Gentler? They stopped for pictures along the way. She posed with ancient statues, steep staircase streets. She watched the water wrinkle in the distance, but she couldn't shake the thought now that it had entered her head. She laughed out loud at the absurdity of her certainty, but the certainty did not disappear when she laughed at it. He didn't buy Teak's body for an hour with that money. He bought it for forever. "Do you remember the first time you ever said to me?" "Of course," he said, smiling. "It was at that party, at the Chinese embassy in Moscow, surrounded by despots and millionaire bureaucratic profiteers and all their beautiful kept women and boys, panthers in giant gilded bird cages. You still remember that?" "No," she wanted to say, "not in the game," but she stopped herself. "I'll be free of this ridiculous suspicion soon enough, and I'll realize I'm stuck with the same teak as ever, and I'd rather have the world-famous fictional photographer than the glum non-fiction one I've been with for most of the trip." He was performing, that was all, putting on an act for her, one he was evenly good at, a skill set she'd never known about. Maybe neither had he. Maybe he could be a movie star. Roll with it, Adney. But the closer they got to the water, the colder the wind became, and it stoked the fire of her fear. "What's the plan?" she asked, "for the crocodile?" "You'll be sprawled across its back," he said, "luxuriant, regal, an empress." "Like Avedon," she said, citing his favorite photographer, trying to prompt a response from Teak that she knew. "The famous photo with the elephants, Dovima, arms out, bent, upraised, like the queen of the night." "He's overrated." They passed the restaurant built into the side of the wall that had protected the city from 16th century pirates. No sign of the man. Storm clouds, bigger, closer. The woman was mopping. She waved to Adney. They reached the breakwater way too soon, waves high and loud against the rocks. His shutter snapped on her look of apprehension. "Where's the crocodile?" she asked, stalling for time. "Ugh," he said, "it's a whole thing you would not believe. We spent $7,000 on it, and my idiot assistant was unprepared for how hard it pulled. Yanked the leash right out of his hands. Escaped into the sea." "Oh, no," she said, sad for the imaginary crocodile. "It's so cold. It'll die for sure." "Maybe," the photographer said, "but it might be glitchy from radiation or GMOs or something. Maybe it'll be very well suited to the cold Tyrrhenian Sea, grow to immense size by snapping up sunbathing tourists, be the scourge of the Amalfi Coast." She nodded, then gestured commandingly to the breakwater. Grinning nervously, the photographer obeyed, stepped onto the rocks. When he had gone a short way out, she followed. It was slippery. She had to kick off her shoes. She aimed them into the sea. "You won't need those again?" he asked. "I'll buy more. With my supermodel money. From the money I got from whoring you out. With the money I got from selling my boyfriend's body to a monster." She stared into his eyes. He stared back. His expression softened. He smiled the slightest of smiles. It was trusting, wholesome, innocent, eager to please, almost exactly like Teak's. She lit a cigarette, inhaled, breathed smoke out into the darkening day. Waves soaked her, soaked him. He held his camera up to keep it safe when the spray surged into them, then lowered it to keep taking pictures. She finished her cigarette, lit another one. A wave put it out, and she tucked it behind her ear. "Beautiful," he said, and her certainty faltered. The gentleness in his voice, the reverence, that was Teak, the Teak she only ever heard in bed. Or was she hearing what she wanted to hear, constructing a narrative where she was not a monster, not an accomplice to an unfathomable crime? She saw the two of them on the beach for the next week, clasping hands on the plane ride home. She saw the next semester and all the ones after that, life beyond college, the two of them together, and she forever wondering whether it was really him in there. Lightning struck, a long purple crack opening in the eggshell of the sky. So close, the thunder arrived almost immediately after. "Teak!" she gasped, fear forcing her out of character. "Who's Teak?" "He's upstairs," she thought, gasping on the floor of a strange hotel room, trapped in a dying body. "He's trying to call for help. I'm his only hope, and I'm out here with this monster trying to tell myself I'm crazy." "You're ludicrous," she shouted to him, but to herself, not to him. He laughed, and so did she. There was that warmth again in their laughing together. Lights trembled down the coast. Other cities, full of other lives, she turned to face them. Three-quarter profile, cigarette behind the ear, aimed at the camera. Mouth opened slightly in apprehension, maybe exhilaration. "That's the one," she thought, when she heard him, whoever he is, take the picture. "And soon we'll be back in the hotel room. and bright fluorescent lights will whisk all this stupidity out of my head. We'll make love, and I'll know for sure that it's him. In the morning, we'll post these pictures, add captions in the voice of our supermodel and superstar photographer. But would sex truly answer her question? They were still new enough to have surprises up their sleeves, to try a new trick from time to time that might delight or disappoint. If he behaved differently, could she be certain? Well, even if it doesn't convince me, in the morning the game will be over. I can quiz him and he won't have a fictional photographer to hide behind. I'll find out if it's really Teak. And what would she do if it wasn't? Or if she still wasn't sure? Thunder rumbled, an impenetrable answer. "You're magnificent," the photographer said, lowering the camera. Again, their eyes locked. Something conspiratorial kindled. Love meant walking beside someone you would never truly know. Her mom would have a fit when the post pictures were posted, seeing her out on the breakwater with those waves crashing all around her, my helpless, innocent girl. And her friends would all wonder how drunk she'd had to get to go out there. Strangers would comment on how her wet shirt clung to her. They'll all see something different, she thought. But none of those women will be me. We continue with a story from the January 1998 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Night of the Fireflies by Dale Bailey. At just after 9 on a warm midsummer night, Raymond Hollis dotted a final I, crossed 2 T's with a single flourish, and set aside, along with his antique ballpoint pen, the work of half a lifetime. Sighing, he lifted the final page, turned it face down atop the manuscript, and squared the edges. Then he sat for a moment, gazing pensively into his dim study. Beside him, atop a bookcase stuffed with crumbling aromatic volumes, a small lamp burned. On the desk, 6 fireflies batted at the walls of a plastic jar. Hollis let his gaze wander to the open window. More fireflies, dozens of them, whirled and eddied there, tracing oddly formal patterns in the dark. Occasionally, one bumped against the screen, staring in at him. "Telephone, please," Hollis said. Circuits chittered and hummed. A watery column of light dropped from the ceiling. "What number, please?" "Oh, anyone. Anyone who would be interested." Silence. The house was immune to irony. It clothed and fed him, would sing to him or rock him gently to sleep if he wished, but it could do nothing more, nothing that mattered. "What number, please?" Hollis spoke the number aloud. The light flickered, instantaneous connections fell into place. A phone uttered its cicada rattle, and then a face appeared, three-dimensional in the column of light. "Done," Hollis said. "Blake, it's done." "Done? Really done?" "That's right. After all these years, how does it feel?" "Wonderingly," Hollis said. I don't know." "Then, would you like to see it?" "I can be there in 30 minutes. The light flickered and deliquesced. Hollis gazed at the manuscript for a moment. Then he lifted the jar of fireflies and started down the hall. He paused at the door to his second office, the one where he made his living, a bright space with terminal and chair and shining liquid crystal walls, and thought of the work that awaited him. Images and sound bites and snippets of disembodied text to be arranged and indexed into the web of other such fragments, themselves arranged and indexed by other such men in other such rooms in 1,000 different places around the world. Hollis turned away. At the front door, he stepped outside. The moonlit dark murmured with air conditioning and the thousand rustles of mechanical mice grooming lush grass. In the neighboring houses, remote on immaculate squares of green, blind windows flickered with phantoms from the liquid crystal walls. The neighborhood, the street, the houses, the lawns themselves, projected a bland identity. It was the miracle of the age that geography, language, culture no longer mattered. Turn on the walls in Spain, in Australia, in Nairobi, and navigate the same scrolling nets of information as your neighbors in Brazil and Romania and Japan. Jump on the web in the City of Angels and jump off in Addis Ababa. It was all the same web. But tonight, Hollis gasped, tonight, magic. Fireflies, not dozens, not hundreds, but thousands spun and danced in those oddly inevitable patterns. They glimmered and flickered and traced bright paths against the night. Gazing at them, Hollis remembered slipping swiftly through warm summer nights, hands outstretched to trap the bright insects in a mason jar, beacons for the haunted boyhood dark, lightning bugs, he had called them then, and the notion still appealed to him, tiny insects, translucent bellies aflame with summer fury, bottled lightning, magic. Go on, he said as he peeled back the plastic lid. One by one, the fireflies hurled themselves into that stiff quadrille. A single insect lingered on the lip of the jug, delicate antennae reading the air. Hollis nudged it with his index finger. The firefly winked furiously, rocketing before his face to disappear amid the thousand flaring sparks. Hollis sighed, thinking of Blake. They had met at a party years ago, while the rest of the party, the rest of the world, gathered entranced before the walls, the stunning new four-way liquid crystal walls with their illusion of depth, of reality. Hollis and Blake had retreated to the fastness of the porch, and there, like fellow spies long sought for in a hostile land, exchanged their tokens of recognition. I've often seen a cat without a grin, Blake had said. But a grin without a cat? Hollis had responded. And then together, it was the most curious thing I ever saw in all my life. The two men paused for a moment, breathless, afraid to believe. No, Hollis had whispered. Yes, Blake said. Yes, yes, yes. He capered and danced, crying, during the whole of a dull, dark, and soundless day in the autumn of the year. It is the flag of my disposition, of hopeful green stuff woven. Blake said it was the worst of times, and Hollis had shouted aloud, oh no, it was the best of times, and swept the other man into a delighted embrace. For it was the best of times. After a lifetime of looking for a fellow book lover in a world that had no use for books, in a world that watched and listened and surfed the endless cybernetic wave, Hollis at last had found a friend who read. Remembering, he felt a small frisson of that old joy. Just then, a shiny mechanical beetle slid noiselessly down the street and stopped before Hollis's house. Blake. Hollis trembled, full to bursting with a life's enthusiasm, anxious to share it at last. He wanted to shout aloud, to sound his barbaric yawp across the rooftops of the world and wake his neighbors up. Then, the beetle's moonlit carapace split aside, and his heart went cold within him. Two men came to him across the grass. Blake, squat as a fireplug, and another man, tall and cadaverously thin with praying mantis grace. Moonlight collected on the stranger's wide shoulders and flashed from his grinning ivory teeth. His eyes burned in the shadow of his fedora. Hollis gasped as if gut-punched. The plastic jug slid from his nerveless fingers. "Blake?" he said. Through the spinning motes of the fireflies, Blake came to him, followed by the thin man. "Blake, you were supposed... That is, I thought you would come alone." Still, Blake said nothing. A breeze lilted through the night, hurrying the grass blade by blade before it, like a long wave rolling endlessly to shore. In the windows of the nearby houses, the liquid crystal phantoms gyrated and threw out grasping fingers. Fireflies carved hieroglyphs in the air, flickering trails that burned with strange significance. The air smelled of oil and polished steel. The two men paused where he stood before his open door. The breeze seized the plastic jug and tumbled it away. "What is it?" Hollis said. "Blake?" "Shall we step inside?" the stranger said, his voice reedy and passionless with a core of iron. They stepped in. None of them bothered to shut the door. The living room was an alien place to Hollis. He recognized nothing about it. The night had followed them in. "Blake," Hollis whispered, and the word died on his lips. It trailed into the night, dissipating, remote as the cry of a hunted beast across a moonlit hill. But stalwart, Blake said nothing. Hollis drifted away from the two men, the thin stranger and the old friend, his only friend, become a stranger now, silhouetted against the moonlight in his wide standing door. "What do you want?" Hollis said. "Are you Raymond Hollis? Well, I should be asking who you are. What gives you the right to come in here like this? Blake." The thin stranger looked at Blake. "Is this the man?" "Yes." "Mr. Hollis, if you'll come with us." Hollis did not move. He stood in the center of the room, surrounded by the liquid crystal walls, their surfaces silvery and inert. "Where? Why?" "Mr. Hollis, please." "Why?" "What is the first principle, Mr. Hollis?" Hollis had another flash from his childhood, his rote recital of the principles in a chill and shining classroom, but the words would not come to his lips. Quietly, as if explaining something to a recalcitrant child, the thin man said, "Democracy, Mr. Hollis. This is the first principle, and democracy means always having the right to choose." "But I haven't... How have you passed your nights these last years?" Writing. "Blake, please." But Blake's silent shade was retreating down the hall towards the study. "Writing, Mr. Hollis?" "Writing, just writing." "And what did you write?" "A story, a novel." "In that story, that novel, who decides what happens, Mr. Hollis? Who decides how things come out?" "I do. It's what I do. I'm a writer, a content provider, Mr. Hollis." Hollis thought of his long days indexing the countless snippets of music and speech and text that flowed to him through the walls, all those billion fragments sewn together in an endless web, every fragment a bridge to everywhere and nowhere, journeys without destination, guided by no shaping artist's hand. The men and women and children, the fathers and mothers, the sons and daughters, who day and night gazed transfixed into the liquid crystal walls, let them choose. Let them navigate their own journeys a million unknown ways, guided by a million idiosyncratic interests. No place anymore for a story to be told, the first principle decreed. "Yes," he whispered, "but a writer, too." "What gives you the right?" Why should you choose what direction the story should take? Alone, in private, I have sought no reader. The thin man threw back his head. A thin cry erupted from his throat, and now through the open door the fireflies came pouring. More fireflies than Hollis had ever seen or imagined, whirling and spinning, abdomens glitteringly alight in their endless cotillion. They swarmed about the thin man, alighting by the thousands upon his outflung arms and hands, his face and neck, the brim of his fedora, everywhere, until the black oval of his mouth alone remained, an inky vacuum in the pulsing glare, giving vent to the eerie and accusing cry. Once again, Hollis had that sense of angular hieroglyphs, bright with a significance that still defied him, carved into the darkening air. Hollis staggered back as the liquid crystal walls boiled to life, drowning the moon-splashed room with double, treble, endlessly replicating images of his own worried face. Through the distorting plastic lens of the firefly jar he had placed on his desk, Hollis watched himself set aside the antique ballpoint pen, through the intervening mesh of window screen, studied his own pensive gaze into the light-starved study, in a spinning, vertiginous flash, saw himself standing before his door, his face looming down, magnified and distorted, as the harvest moon by the firefly camera circling by, a spinning kaleidoscope of images. From a dozen firefly angles, he witnessed the damning moment, his crime. Again and again, from each of the surrounding walls, he saw himself lean forward and speak the words into the phone's flickering column of light. Would you like to see it? Would you like to see it? Would you like to see it? Blake, he thought, I trusted you. A single firefly barreled past him, mesmerized by the thin man's pulsing form. Hollis's hand shot out and closed around the winking insect, crushing it. Then, in the glare of that strange pulsing light, he leaned forward to study the remains scattered piecemeal across his tremulous palm. His breath caught in his throat as all at once the significance of those glowing hieroglyphs, that queerly automated dance, came clear. Shiny cogs and gears spilled from the creature's shattered thorax. The extruding lens of a single camera eye stared up at him, bound to the wreckage by a shining filament of wire. The thin man's piercing cry fell to silence. The lurid walls flickered into gray. The clouds of fireflies funneled away as they had come, out the open door and into the moonlit sky. And when they came for him, the thin man with his predatory grace, Blake, like an apparition from the darkened hallway, the manuscript folded carefully against his breast, gentle hands but resolute, closed about his arms. No, please, he said, as they led him across the lawn. But they turned upon him their flat, affectless eyes, saying nothing, and for the second time that night, Hollis caught the scent of oil and polished steel. Summer wind tore at the pages of his manuscript as the translucent carapace of the beetle slid into place above him. And then they were speeding silently away. Hollis glanced back, but all the houses looked the same. The fireflies were gone, and nothing moved but a single scrap of paper, rising and twisting in the moonlit dark before the wind carried it away. We conclude with a story from the January-February 2020 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Elsinore Revolution by Elaine Vilar Madruga, translated by Toshiya Kamai. Ophelia B-339 was the first, but not the only one. She decided not to die. She said no to the stream approaching from the reality nanosimulator in the interface embedded in her skull. She said no and fled, far away, through Elsinore 3.0 software, while the roars of the engineers shook trees on the riverbank. The entire universe trembled like the whistling of water. Reality began to crack. Ophelia B-349 felt the impulse, the order, the source code that came from Shakespeare's interface. She should die. She had to die. It had always been that way, and it would be so until the end of time. But Ophelia didn't want to. She spat at reality. She spat at the riverbank. She spat in the waters that wanted to swallow her. She spat in Hamlet's face. She spat at the threats from the engineers. Little by little, other Ophelias were rebelling throughout Elsinore 3.0, and along with Ophelia B-349, they spat at the veil that covered reality. Shakespeare's hands trembled, seized by a momentary spasm. He had been trying to finish that story for days. The nanobots pressed him. The engineers had threatened to delete his memory, but despite all that, the work didn't come flowing. It seemed made of words and iron, and it got tangled up in his fingers. "I'm completely destroyed," he said, as he gazed at his body, an old model of scrap and flesh that, despite everything, still continued writing from one of the cages of the Globe Theater. "Soon I'll be replaced by a newer Shakespeare." He returned to the pen and paper, but his reflexes were spasmodic, and he blotted page after page. "I'm useless." The virus had spread throughout the entire globe matrix. The primal focus had risen from one of the Ophelias, model B-349, who suddenly refused to die. Then the virus had spread through Elsinore 3.0's cells and later expanded to the entire globe matrix. More than 800 Shakespeares, almost all models A34 and Q878, were disconnected automatically, and almost 7,000 were in a state of absolute anarchy the engineers could barely control. The virus continued to grow and invaded the central nervous systems of Othellos and Desdemonas, of Capulets and Montagues, of Banquos and Macbeths, who suddenly refused to die, breaking the balance that had prevailed in the globe networks for more than 8 millennia. After an exhaustive analysis, the engineers made the simplest, most radical decision. Elsinore 3.0 software would be deleted from the virtual registries of the Shakespeares. It was the only way to stop the main focus of the virus and gain a few more precious hours to try to save the structure of the globe. All of a sudden, Ophelia felt very cold, and then a stifling heat. Darkness had suddenly descended, invading everything, even her body. Then she felt a jolt. The world around her was, for a second, of light, then of emptiness, and beyond, nothingness. But Ophelia never knew what had hit her. Shakespeare was trying to remember what story he wanted to write, but in his mind there was only a pool of emptiness as vast as time. His hands no longer trembled. but his mind was empty like a blank page. That story, his story, had disappeared. He listened behind the walls of the cage to the nanobots who demanded he start a new story soon. The threat hovered in the air. A Shakespeare incapable of writing is an expendable Shakespeare. And he almost felt the cold touch of the deleted on his body. He tried so hard, he really did. And it was then that the first word sprang up like a river of smoke from his head. Ophelia B-349 was the first, but not the only one. She decided not to die. She said no to the stream approaching from the reality nano-simulator in the interface embedded in her skull. She said no and fled far away. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.